Thank you so much for downloading the newest edition of Be Conscious. I am Damian Barling. Richard Rothstein, the author of Color of Law, is going to join me here in just a couple of minutes. Richard is a historian, he's a professor, and he has studied segregation in America as it pertains to housing and education for decades. And Color of Law is a fascinating read and really lays out why so many of the policies, housing policies that were put into place decades, century ago, those policies may not technically exist. We're still very much feeling the ramifications of them today. It's a wonderful conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. And it's a fantastic book that I really encourage you to check it out. Richard Rothstein, Color of Law. So he'll be with us here in just a couple of minutes. We haven't really dug into the midterms yet and what's going on in Florida and Georgia. We're going to do that next week. A good friend of mine, Kamara Williams, he's an attorney in Florida, and he's been dealing with everything that's going on down there. He worked on Andrew Gillum's campaign. He's going to be with us next week to discuss that. We also haven't had the opportunity to discuss things that we normally discuss on this program, like, I don't know, maybe a security guard who was doing his job and perhaps saved a bar of patrons from potentially being murdered. We haven't discussed him being shot by police because police have a fear of large black men, as we've grown to know and have seen on a number of occasions. But I'm not in the right mind state to cover that today. We'll get to that one next week as well. I want to get to our conversation with Richard Rothstein. I'm so happy he's here with us. I hope you enjoy this. Again, the book is called The Color of Law, and Richard's with us now. And you know, one thing that I picked up on your book, Rich, which I'm always fascinated by, is I don't feel like the Reconstruction era gets a lot of attention. Now, you do cover it in the book, but I think the Reconstruction era is an incredible time in America that really doesn't get discussed enough.
Well, I do talk about that in the book. I talk about how the end of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow forced African Americans out of many communities where they were thriving in the very early 20th century and late 19th century. I have that whole section, don't I, about Montana?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And then I discuss the Wilson administration. Don't I discuss the Wilson administration and the segregation of the civil service in the book?
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's it. But when what I look at with the Reconstruction era is when you're in, and maybe this is to go down more to an elementary level, is when you're taught in school, it's like slavery, freedom, civil rights. Yay! Look how happy America is today. And I feel like the Reconstruction era is so vital. And it's so often ignored, which is one of the reasons that I think your book is so valuable.
I agree, but there are lots of good books written about Reconstruction. In fact, 55 years ago, I was teaching high school. That'll tell you how old I am. I was teaching high school, and I assigned the book that I think had the most impact on my students was a book by Howard Fast called Freedom Road. Mm. Which was a popularization of the Reconstruction era and its tragic end. But, you know, the purpose of my book is not to describe the full scope of African-American history, but to talk about the explicit government policies that created housing segregation.
Right.
And because government wasn't terribly much involved in housing until the New Deal. There's not much to write about before that. I do talk in the book about the violence that African Americans frequently faced when they moved into white neighborhoods. It was protected by the police and enforced by prosecutors, and that would certainly be a form of a government-sponsored segregation, enforcement of segregation that took place. Prior to the New Deal, but the big impact of the federal government in creating housing segregation were the New Deal policies. And so that's where I place most of my emphasis.
And I think I'm paraphrasing a line from a book here, but from your book, if a policy doesn't exist in writing, that doesn't mean the after effects of the policy have been fixed. And how much of the after effects of policies that were written 100 years ago or however many years ago are still being felt today.
Well, you, as I describe in the book, once you've created this unconstitutional system of residential segregation, race-neutral policies can reinforce it and maintain it. You don't need to continue to be race-conscious once you've set up the structure. So, for example, as I talk about in the book, the Section 8 voucher program, which is a subsidy to low-income, mostly, it turns out to be mostly minority families or disproportionately minority families, that's a race-neutral program, but it reinforces segregation because the vouchers are usable because of the conditions of the vouchers, mostly only in low-income segregated neighborhoods. The same thing is true of the low-income housing tax credit program today. It's a race-neutral program, but most developments of low-income housing is placed in already low-income segregated neighborhoods. So, yeah, once we've set up these structures, these unconstitutional structures through government policy, race-neutral policies can reinforce it unless they are explicitly designed to undo it.
Is that de facto segregation? Would that be a fair way to describe what you just laid out?
No, I think the whole purpose of my book is to say that de facto segregation is a myth. There's no basis in reality to it whatsoever. Policies that reinforce de jure segregation are not de facto segregation. De facto segregation means that the segregation, the basic segregation, just sort of happened by accident. It happened because of private prejudice. The Section 8 voucher thing that I'm talking about, I just described to you, or the low-income housing tax credit, doesn't require private prejudice. The reason that low-income house credit programs, developments, are mostly placed in low-income African-American neighborhoods is not because developers are prejudiced. It's because it's easier to build there because of the structure of the program. The land is cheaper there. It's they don't have to face community opposition. Because it's located in a neighborhood with lots of low-income people already living there, it's easy to rent an apartment. People walk by and see a vacancy sign. So it's not because the developers are racially prejudiced. It's just that the incentives are all to do it the easiest way, which is to reinforce segregation. And the same thing is true of the Section 8 voucher program. It's not a racially conscious program. But it's structured so that these vouchers are administered by a local housing agency. And the local housing agency's jurisdiction is typically just within the municipal boundaries. So you can't use a Section 8 voucher to rent housing in middle-class suburban communities that are outside the metropolitan area. That's not a racially explicit policy, but it reinforces segregation.
So just to follow up on that, you, de facto segregation you don't believe is real. This is actual segregation.
What I'm saying is that, yeah, we have a myth, a national myth, that the racial boundaries in every metropolitan area are created by accident. We call this de facto segregation, the result of private prejudice, not government action. The racial boundaries, the concentration of African Americans in frequently low-income African-American neighborhoods, the exclusive presence of whites in overwhelmingly white suburbs, this was the result of government policy. It's not de facto segregation. And just because the government policies no longer are being maintained, it doesn't make it de facto segregation. It was the product of explicit, it's a civil rights violation everywhere. Have these racial boundaries. And the civil rights violation doesn't disappear just because the policies that created it are no longer being explicitly pursued.
How segregated are some of the large cities in America now?
Every large metropolitan area is residentially segregated. You know, I go around the country speaking about this. Every place I go to tries to convince me that their city is worse than any other. But every metropolitan area is segregated, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong on here. Compton, California is notorious, through John Singleton in movies and in 80s and 90s and even current hip hop. But wasn't Compton once a white area?
Sure.
Like a prominent white area.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, I guess white flight, everybody moved out.
Well, but as I explain in my book, white flight is another misleading term. It implies that somehow this was the result of white attitudes. The reality is this was a federal subsidy that was created by the Federal Housing Administration to get whites to move into more distant suburbs. So this was not simply a question of whites deciding to flee.
Mm-hmm.
This was the product of explicit government policy.
Was it post-war that a lot of these policies came into place because there were soldiers coming back and they had to boot black people out of their homes so these soldiers had a place to return to? Could that be pinpointed as a starting point?
No, that's not how it started. It started much earlier. It started at the beginning of the New Deal. When the government first got involved in housing, the federal government, one of its first programs, New Deal programs in the Depression under the Franklin Roosevelt administration, was the Public Works Administration that created the first civilian public housing in this country. It was explicitly segregated, separate projects for whites and blacks, frequently. Creating segregation in communities that hadn't known segregation before. We had a lot more urban integration mid-early 20th century than we have today. We would be stunned if we were somehow transported back to that period to see the extent of residential integration that existed. I speak in my book, The Color of Law, about the great African-American novelist, playwright Langston Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
Says he grew up in an integrated Cleveland neighborhood in the early 20th century. He said his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. This was not unusual in early 20th century America because there were many integrated neighborhoods for the simple reason that industry, warehouses, factories, had to be located near either a deep water port or a railroad terminal to get parts and ship their final products. And workers didn't have automobiles, so they had to be able to live close enough to the same factory district, the same employment district, to be able to walk to work or take short streetcar rides. So there were many integrated neighborhoods for that reason. If you had a factory district that was employing African-American workers and Jewish workers and Italian workers and Irish workers and Polish workers, they all had to be living in the roughly same neighborhoods. Well, the Public Works Administration came into that integrated Cleveland neighborhood called the Central Neighborhood of Cleveland, demolished housing, and built two separate projects, one for whites and one for African Americans, creating a program of segregation throughout the metropolitan Cleveland area with that and other projects that created a pattern that still exists today. And this was done all over the country in the 1930s, wherever the Public Works Administration and its successor housing agencies, federal housing agencies, built housing. Cambridge, Massachusetts thinks of itself as being a very liberal place today. They look down on the rest of us. But the area between Harvard and MIT was a similarly integrated neighborhood. It was about half white, half black in the 1930s. The Public Works Administration created segregation there by creating a pattern of creating separate projects, one for whites, one for African-Americans, and creating a pattern of segregation with that and other segregated projects throughout the Boston metropolitan area that still persists today. Now, you're correct that there was another big wave of federal involvement when returning war veterans came home, and they needed housing. But it's not that they needed to displace African-Americans. Both black and white war veterans needed housing. But what the federal government did was created a program by the Federal Housing Administration that was designed to get all white working-class families out of urban areas and into single-family homes in the suburbs. This was a program of the Federal Housing Administration for returning war veterans. African-Americans were not permitted to participate in this program. They had to rent housing in urban areas. White families were subsidized by the federal government to move out of urban areas. Many of them didn't have housing. They were living in Quonset huts or doubled or tripled up with relatives into single-family homes in all white suburbs. This was an explicit policy of the Federal Housing Administration, primarily for returning war veterans, but for other white families as well. Your listeners are familiar, I'm sure, with these developments. They were all over the country. The biggest one was Levittown, east of New York City. In California, there was a song that maybe you've heard about little boxes on a hillside made of ticky-tacky, and they all look the same. That was about a development just as large as Levittown that was south of San Francisco. Those developments could never have been built with private capital. A developer like Levitt in Levittown, or Henry Dolger, the developer of the little boxes south of San Francisco, a community called Westlake, could never have developed the capital to build a development of 15,000 homes, 17,000 homes in one place. No bank would be crazy enough to lend the developer that capital. The only way those developments were built was by the Federal Housing Administration giving bank guarantees to these developers on condition, on explicit condition, that they never sell a home to an African-American. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt and Dolger and these other builders to place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African-Americans or rental to African-Americans. So on that basis, the white working-class population was suburbanized. The suburbanization of the country that we know today was created by the Federal Housing Administration on a racially explicit basis. Those two programs, and I could go on and on giving you more examples, but I won't, but those two programs, the construction of public housing by the federal government beginning in 1933, and the subsidization of white families to move into racially exclusive suburbs, are the two biggest programs that created the metropolitan area boundaries, racial boundaries that exist today. They were unconstitutional programs. They were a violation of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. They were civil rights violations. They are just as unconstitutional, the racial boundaries that result from these two policies and many, many others as well, other policies as well. Those just as unconstitutional as the segregation of water fountains or lunches or lunch counters or buses or any of the other forms of segregation that we addressed in the 20th century. We've not addressed this one. It's the biggest segregation of all. We addressed all these other forms of segregation. We've not addressed this one because we've convinced ourselves of a national myth that residential segregation was created by accident. It was created by private prejudice. It was created by discriminating real estate agents or banks. It was created by income differences. It was created by demographic trends. Nothing that government had anything to do with. And therefore, it's not a civil rights violation. That's a myth. There's no basis in reality to it whatsoever. The government is as responsible, if not more so, for the residential segregation of neighborhoods as it was for the segregation of buses and lunch counters and water fountains and parks and swimming pools and schools and colleges. We addressed all of those. We've never addressed residential segregation because we've convinced ourselves that it's not our responsibility to do so.
If you want more examples, they're in the book, The Color of Law. It's a fantastic read. And there's a point midway through, because you brought up California there. It's around midway through the book, excuse me, where you talked about the segregation in California. And I think you specifically noted maybe it was Stanford or, you know, Palo Alto areas around Stanford. And that was kind of jarring to me because we don't think of California like that anymore. We think of California as this, you know, liberal, progressive, we're way ahead of the curve when back then California was just doing what the rest of the country was doing.
Well, you're absolutely right. As I said before, I like to talk about self-satisfied places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and California is another one. Perhaps the example that you're referring to is outside of Stanford. The novelist Wallace Stegner was recruited to teach writing at Stanford University after World War II. He couldn't find housing. There was an enormous housing shortage. So he participated, joined a cooperative along with some other families, 100 families in this cooperative, working class, middle class families, college professors, school teachers, postmen, tradespeople, 100 families. They bought land outside Stanford University. They plan to build 400 homes on this giant ranch that they had purchased. They went to a bank, or several banks, to try to get a loan for the construction of these homes. The bank went to the federal government. The federal government would not guarantee the loans that the bank would give to these to this cooperative, because this 100-person cooperative had 3 African-American members. And the Federal Housing Administration insisted that unless the cooperative expelled these 3 members, there would be no possibility of a bank guarantee. Eventually, the cooperative had to disband. They sold its land to a private developer who was willing to segregate the community and refused to sell homes to African-Americans. He built a large subdivision outside Stanford University, which had clauses in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African-Americans or rental to African-Americans, that gave him the ability to get bank loans for the construction of federally government-guaranteed bank loans for the construction of this development. So California was no different from the rest of the country in this respect.
I had a friend who owned a house in Land Park, which is an area in Sacramento, California, where this podcast originates from. And I think the house was built in like maybe the 40s or something along those lines. And on the original, he showed me the original deed of the house that said all Negroes must be out of the house by sunset. And I just remember staring at that like, is this for real? Like, this is on a legal document. This is on a house deed that black people have to be out of your house before the sun goes down. And I just found that extraordinary.
Well, if you would make a copy of that deed, your friend's deed, and send it to me, I'd be grateful. I continue to accumulate evidence about this.
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to. What role did, if any, did Franklin Delano Roosevelt play in housing segregation at the time?
Well, his administration, all of the policies I was describing, or several of the public housing in the 1930s and the beginnings of the Federal Housing Administration policy that I've been describing, were done in his administration. I don't know that this was his idea or he even approved of it, but Roosevelt's position was that he only had one priority in the 1930s, and that was to end the Depression. He only had one priority in the 1940s, and that was to win the war. And he was unwilling to undertake any policy that would be in any way controversial, that would splinter his coalition to either fight the Depression in the 1930s or win the war in the 1940s. So he was passive with regard to these policies. They were all done in his administration, but he was passive. His wife continued to press him.
Mm-hmm.
To end these policies of segregation, but he explained to her that, in his view, he could only have 2 priorities, and that was the end of the discussion.
You've laid out the issue brilliantly in this book, in the history of the issue, but how does segregation like this get rectified now, you know, 100 years later, almost 100 years later?
Well, once we understand that residential segregation is a civil rights violation as much as the residential segregation of, or as much as the segregation of other institutions that we addressed in the 20th century. Once we understand it's a civil rights violation because it was created by government, it's very easy to design policies to desegregate. Thinking of the policies isn't hard. Educating the public about this history is much harder, so that the public accepts the obligation to enforce the Constitution. I described to you a few minutes ago how the Section 8 and the low-income housing tax credit programs reinforce segregation. Both of those programs could very easily be modified so that they create an incentive for desegregation. Thinking of how to modify those regulations isn't hard at all. We could subsidize the purchase of homes by African Americans in communities from which they were once excluded and which now, because they've appreciated in value, are unaffordable to working class families of any race. Those kinds of subsidies would be a perfectly justifiable, narrowly targeted remedy for a specific constitutional violation. We should pursue them, but unless we understand that there's a constitutional violation involved, we're not going to begin to develop such policies. So there are many, many policies that we could follow to desegregate this country, to permit and create the opportunity for African Americans to live where they choose. But we're not going to follow those policies, easy though they are to design, until we develop a new civil rights movement that's going to demand them.
In your experiences speaking, touring, obviously doing interviews like this one and promoting the book, do you find that people believe this is a constitutional violation? Or are people resistant to it?
No, nobody's resistant to it. And I will say this, that the book has been out now for a year and a half, The Color of Law. It's been out for a year and a half. Not a single fact has been challenged by any professional historian, or by anyone for that matter. The subtitle of the book, the title is The Color of Law, but the subtitle is A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This was once well known. Nothing that I've talked to you about in the last few minutes was a secret. Mm-hmm. People certainly knew what the deeds in their homes said. People knew when they accepted public housing or looked at public housing in the 1930s that there were some projects that were explicitly for African Americans and others that were explicitly for whites. This was no secret. So the facts are not in dispute, but many people, most of us, have forgotten this history. The term de facto segregation is widely held. It's used by not just whites, but African Americans, not just Republicans, but Democrats. It's used by people of all persuasions. It's a common national myth, and the myth has to be demolished before we can be in a position to take steps to remedy it.
Could this be could someone run with this as part of a political platform? Whether it's 2020 or an election down the line, is this something someone could run on?
Well, someday, but we first need to develop much more public awareness of this this issue. For example, right now, Senator Elizabeth Warren, a senator from Massachusetts, has introduced a bill in Congress, a remedy bill, a bill that subsidizes the purchases of homes by residents of low-income, segregated neighborhoods so that they can afford to buy homes that would otherwise be unaffordable to them. It's a remedy for unconstitutional segregation. Personally, I think her bill is silly at this point because there's no political foundation for it. It's not going to go anywhere. People won't understand why it's necessary. I would rather see her going around the country making speeches about this history and about the unconstitutional nature of our racial boundaries and the enormous costs we pay for it, than introducing legislation that's for which there's yet no political support. And I'd like to see all progressive politicians doing that. But this is not yet the time for legislation to remedy this. This is the time for public engagement, public organization, political organization, a new civil rights movement, as I said before.
Mr. Rothstein, this was fascinating. I can't thank you enough for your time, and I can't thank you enough for the book. It was absolutely a tremendous account of history, and I really appreciate your time today.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
The book is called The Color of Law. That's Richard Rothstein right there. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation, and I cannot recommend this book enough. There is so much information out there. There is so much historical information in his book, and there is such a direct tie-in to why we see segregated neighborhoods today in 2018 based off policies that were made up centuries ago. If you're into reading about history, if you're into understanding the past and current state of race relations, and if you're subscribing to this podcast, I'm assuming that you are, check out this book, Color of Law, Richard Rothstein. absolutely fantastic. And again, Mr. Rothstein, we're so happy you were able to join us today. If you got any feedback on today's show or any ideas for future shows, go ahead and send it my way. DamianBarling@me.com. That's the email address if you want to send something lengthy. If you just want to hit me across the social media platforms, you could do that as well. At Damian Barling on Twitter, Damian Barling on Facebook, and Damian Barling on Instagram. I'm not very creative when it comes to my social media tags. I just use my name. So Damian Barling, you can reach out to me there. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do. We'd love to have you back each and every single week. If you haven't dug into the archives yet, we've got some incredible programs there. We talked to David Steele a couple of weeks ago about the 50th anniversary of the Mexico City Games and John Carlos and Tommy Smith. He wrote Tommy Smith's book with him. You should check that out. Our very first episode featuring Howard Bryant is amazing. Our most popular episode, at least as of last week, is the one called White Fragility with Dr. D'Angelo. Go back and take a listen to that if you're new to the program. Also, if you're new, when you hit subscribe, you could hit the 5-star review. That helps us get noticed a little bit more on iTunes and Google Play and all of these different podcast platforms. So we appreciate you so much for being here. We hope you come back. And again, Damian Barling across all social media platforms if you want to reach out. Appreciate you so much for being with us. We'll see you next Thursday when Kamara Williams joins us to discuss the election, the campaign, and the recount that is going on in the state of Florida right now.